Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim Dennis is still recuperating in the hospital. We thank everybody for the prayers and kind messages that they've been leaving on our social media and emailing us and contacting Tim. It is definitely appreciated. He is dealing currently with a form of sepsis in his blood, and they're working to try to conquer this and get him back on his feet, literally and figuratively. So just keep pouring out the good thoughts and intentions and prayers. It's all appreciated. And we'll be hearing from Tim on True Crime Tuesday with the Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals. We'll connect with him for this. You can hear it today. It's available right now. And again, if you haven't subscribed to our True Crime podcast, it's very easy. Just go to darknessradio.com, click on the True Crime Tuesday banner, and you can subscribe now. It's only $5 a month. That's just $1.25 per episode. And you get four brand new 90 to 120-minute episodes delivered every week. And these are some of the most fascinating true crime tales. Plus, you always get the fun of Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals at the end of each show. Sure. So check that out. We're going to talk tonight with Steve Alton, who's joining us. He is the co-author, editor, and publisher of a book called Acknowledged, and it's an expose of the world's greatest secret. He co-wrote this with Stephen Greer, Dr. Stephen Greer. He's also the author of a novel called Undisclosed, and it's the first time that he's visiting us, with us here on the show. He grew up in Philadelphia, earning his bachelor's degree in physical education at Penn State University, a master's degree in sports medicine from the University of Delaware, and a doctorate of education at Temple University. Much too smart, but he's still here with us this evening. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dave. The honor is mine. I just want to make one correction. The Greer book that I wrote with him is called Unacknowledged.
Oh, Unacknowledged. I apologize.
Hopefully with shows like yours, we can get it acknowledged, but right now it's called Unacknowledged.
Great. Well, talk to me about this. With this book coming out, the biggest lie in history is about to be shattered. That's part of the press release on this. What drew you to this story and working with Dr. Greer?
It's a pretty amazing story how I got started with him. Back in 2011, I had written a thriller called Phobos, which is part of a Mayan calendar doomsday prophecy, the third in a trilogy. And there was a section of the book that dealt with UFOs and extraterrestrials. So in doing my research, I came across, amongst a lot of material by Dr. Stephen Greer, the Disclosure Project, which was something that he organized back in May of 2001, where he had 20 highly classified, highly top secret rated testimonials from people in the military, the FAA, intelligence agencies, and the like. And I was so impressed by the quality of his testimonials, the people that were giving them, that I contacted Dr. Greer and I asked him for permission to use excerpts from the testimonials in between chapters of the book. And he was very kind and he allowed me to do so. And so when the book was done, I sent it to him and his wife read it. And a year later, I got a call from his wife, Emily, that said, we're going to be in Miami. Would you like to have dinner with us and your wife? And I said, sure, that's great. We'll see you in December. Well, 3 days before we were supposed to get together for dinner to meet for the first time, my wife and I, it was a Saturday night, my wife and I were driving home from a movie, and it was about 11 o'clock at night, and we're passing through our neighborhood in Palm Beach County, Florida, and I look up in the sky and I see these lights, these amber lights that are coming across from south to north in staggered pairs, only about 1,000 feet off the ground, perfectly silent. And we got out of the car to look at these things. And as they passed over our head, we can see the silhouette of a saucer-shaped object. And as we watched, they moved through the cloudless sky and disappeared into the ether. It was unbelievable. And we weren't scared or anything. We were thrilled. It was like a privilege to be able to watch these things. So 3 nights later, we got together in Miami Beach with the Greer family. And of course, the first thing out of our mouths was, you're not going to believe what happened to us. And Dr. Greer sort of took it all in stride. He said, well, that's a common occurrence for people he's going to meet for the first time. It's like the interstellars are checking you out through thought energy. And I thought that was pretty amazing. And we spoke that night about the challenges that Dr. Greer's had in his work, which is basically getting through the gauntlet of security in the mainstream media and, to get the public aware about the things that are going on in his life with the extraterrestrials and interstellars, and the fact that he briefed 2 presidents and members of Congress, but couldn't get the word out to the public. So that meeting started a series of meetings we would have over the next couple of years to devise a strategy to get the word out to the public, not to convince them that extraterrestrials existed, because if you there are millions of people that have seen UFOs out there, so they're already convinced. But to create a strategy to get past the gauntlet of the mainstream media, and also to get the word out about zero-point energy, which is this amazing free, clean energy source that has been out there for quite a while. That was one way it was created, was through, not created, but discovered, was through reverse engineering these UFO craft that went down over Roswell and other places. And so, like I said, we sort of devised a strategy that we would create 2 books together, and he would also create a new documentary called Unacknowledged. So there's Unacknowledged, the book which came out on April 25th of this year. There's Unacknowledged, the documentary, which was created by Sony, a division of Sony called The Orchard. And there's my book that just came out last week, which is called Undisclosed, which is a fictional thriller, but it's really faction, meaning that the fiction is wrapped around the real truth about extraterrestrial zero-point energy and all these secrets that have been covered up over the last 70 years.
All right. To write about this and fictionalize it for fantasy books and sci-fi novels, that's one thing. Did you have a real belief in the existence of UFOs and alien races prior to your own eyewitnessing a craft?
Well, it's a good question, Dave, because what I felt is that as an intelligent human being, I believe in the mathematical equation that if there's literally billions of galaxies out there and trillions of star systems and trillions of planets out there, then even if it's 1 in a million shot that life can be evolved on one of these planets, then there'd still be millions and millions and millions of species out there. So surely that seemed to me like it made more sense than we were the only life forms in the entire universe. That made no sense to me at all. But then again,
but the idea that they would traverse these galaxies or universe to get to our planet to simply observe us or anal probe us, as the joke is on most cases, that aspect of it seems the most far-fetched to me. Why just come to observe?
Well, and that's a great question, because this is what made most sense to me in interviewing Dr. Greer over hundreds of hours of interviews and listening to his testimonials from his new eyewitnesses in the military and intelligence agencies. What made sense is that we've been visited before over thousands of years. There's evidence in paintings, there's evidence in cave drawings, there's evidence in hieroglyphics. But the serious stuff didn't happen until World War II. And what drew the attention of the interstellars, and there's many species, I think by some count, over 20 to 30 species that have visited us. What really drew their attention to us was that the teenagers had discovered matches and gasoline. And that was, we were testing thousands of tests of these for the Manhattan Project for these atomic weapons. And that's when they started showing up. It was during World War II that these objects that were energy drones called food fighters were buzzing, sort of shadowing our bombardiers in England, in our American bombardiers and German bombardiers as well. And each side thought it was the other side that was doing this. And what broke the gauntlet a little bit was that FDR sent a general over to the war in Europe. And he was able to come to the conclusion that these objects, these Foo Fighters, were not of this world. The next thing that happened was in 1947, almost 70 years to the day that we're speaking, that the Roswell Air Force Base was being buzzed by UFOs. And now, why Roswell, of all places? Well, what made sense was because that Roswell had the only Air Force that was armed with nuclear weapons. And New Mexico, of course, was the testing grounds of the new atomic weapons leading up to the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, in fact, if you look at all the UFO sightings, the biggest ones have happened over military bases that store nuclear weapons. That's the reason that the interstellars came to us. They're not just to do anal probe, as you say.
Right.
But well,
You say it was kind of the 40s when we started into this, and that's where it really kind of began. But there are recorded sightings going back even into the 1800s and much earlier. If you look at even some of the questionable cave paintings that they've found of these beings, I understand that the concept that, wow, we made a spark and suddenly they took a notice of us. And certainly they've played that angle up in movies, even including the Star Trek franchise, right? That once they realized that we were cracking some codes, then it was okay to start observation. Do you believe that it really, the eyewitness accounts and things prior to that might have been mistakes, and that really it began in the 40s after the World War II or after the bombs were dropped?
No, I believe, as you believe, that they were here for thousands of years and that they were easily made themselves known to our ancestors. When I say the serious stuff began during World War II and beyond, the serious stuff and the fact that there are four different types of civilizations. There's a type 1, type 2, and type 3 civilization, 3 being the most advanced. But there's also a type 0 civilization. That's the most dangerous one to be. That's what we are. We are a type 0 civilization in that we're still using fossil fuels, but we have the knowledge of being able to annihilate ourselves and our planet, and we don't have the necessary discipline not to do it, and that makes us dangerous.
Now, we certainly take notice, or they take notice of us, once this nuclear capability arises, and they're more aware. But then when you start to look into that aspect, doesn't it seem strange that that would be the areas, those would be the most populated and viewed areas for these alien craft? Because, again, it should be that if these things are appearing in the skies over nuclear facilities, over military installations, why are we not scrambling black jets and helicopters and warplanes on these things on a pretty consistent basis?
Well, as is disseminated in the book Unacknowledged and my storyline Undisclosed, that's exactly what we did. But you have to realize that these things are traveling in a higher dimension, that in order to cross the galaxy, as they've done, you can't travel at the speed of light, which sounds pretty fast, but if you're 1,000 light years away and it takes you 1,000 years to get here, it doesn't make any sense unless they're cryogenically frozen, which they weren't.
Right.
But they're traveling using zero-point energy way beyond light speed. They're traveling interdimensionally, transdimensionally, and that's how they communicate as well. Dr. Greer was the one who figured out that they're able to communicate with each other over great distances using thought energy. And this actually occurred to him when he had a near-death experience. Of all things, you mentioned your radio partner has sepsis. Well, Dr. Greer had sepsis when he was 17 or 18 years old, and he literally had a near-death experience. And when he died, his spiritual energy was in communication up in space with these life forms, and they communicated to him and taught him a lot of things and basically gave him the choice of whether to go back to his body and complete his mission on Earth or stay with them. And he chose to go back, and he fought to get back into his body, and he recovered from his sepsis. But that was an important learning experience to him, because years earlier, as a young boy, he had actually had a UFO experience where he and a bunch of friends of his looked up into the sky and they saw a UFO. Of course, nobody believed it. His parents, you know, scolded him for making up lies, but that was true. And that spurred him on to do transcendental meditation and other types of Far East meditations, and so that he was able to practice out-of-body experiences as a teenager. And so that when he did pass away from a near-death experience from the sepsis, he felt very comfortable being in space. And he used that knowledge later on in life to be able to communicate in what he called CE5 episodes, CE5 being close encounters of the fifth kind, which where there's encounters that were actually precipitated by humans to extraterrestrials using thought energy.
Walk me through this, if you will. So we've got 1947, late June, three extraterrestrial craft were downed outside of Roswell Air Force Base. Are these
correct,
downed? Are when you're referring to them as being downed, do you believe that these were shot down? Were they crashes? What do you think occurred? What does Dr. Stephen Greer weigh in on this with?
Well, Dr. Greer and his eyewitnesses to the event relay that it was a scalar weapon being scalar waves, which are beyond light speed waves. And that's what took them down. And two of the vehicles crashed into each other, and another wasn't discovered until a couple years later on farmland, I believe. But of the ones that crashed, that hit each other and crashed and were recovered, there was actually a lot of dead extraterrestrials, a lot of dead grays, but the one that was still alive was held captive for 3 years, and they learned a lot from him.
Where did this weapon emanate from? Was it something we were shooting at them? Was it something they were shooting at each other? Where does this weapon come into play?
I can't say exactly sure who created the weapon or how it was developed, but it was something that we had developed by 1947, and Roswell was the base that was armed with it. And it wasn't just the three.
So you are saying then that the craft were downed because we knocked them out of the sky purposely?
Absolutely.
Or were we testing something and they happened to fly through this ray and it disrupted what they were doing and dropped them?
We targeted them.
All right.
And you have to realize, you know, yes, interstellars are friendly, or they're here for our greater good. But of course, back in 1947, there were a lot of things going on. We had just come out of the World War. We were in a Cold War with the Russians. And now we're being buzzed by these, obviously a very intelligent species that's far beyond our technologies. And so that the thought process is, how do we deal with this? We got to keep it from the public. And we also want to keep it from the communists, the USSR at that time. Because we're in competition with them. You know, not only we have atomic weapons, but we're now testing H-bombs, which hydrogen weapons, which are far more destructive than the atomic weapons that destroyed Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And so what the president at that time, which is Truman, you know, he had a lot on his plate to deal with. And when Eisenhower eventually became president and took over for him, one of the first things he did was he had Rockefeller create a new entity that was going to handle all these sightings, that was going to deal with all these extraterrestrial ships and the reverse engineering of them. And so that's how MJ-12 or Majestic 12 was created.
Okay. See, now this is where it gets interesting to me. So we've got this technology to knock UFOs out of the sky.
Correct.
They aim for it. They knock them out over Roswell. Now, doesn't this seem to kind of fly in the face of logic with what happens next, with the military being called in and Jesse Marcel and the press agent at that time releasing that it is a downed saucer? If this was something that we legitimately knocked out of the sky, we wanted to keep secret, why would the first wave of defense been somebody that was uninitiated to what was going on at that time?
Well, I'm not sure they exactly knew what was going to happen when they shot the scalar waves at them. They had never tested it before, so they weren't sure what the conclusion was. But when it was knocked down, the first ones on the scene were the local authorities, and they didn't know to keep it quiet. There was no entity. There was no NSA. There was no CIA. There was there was no Majestic 12 to call in to handle the situation. So,
but as you said, there was a military base. And if they know that they just knocked something out of the sky, why would they not have sent their planes over to identify what had just happened? It was right there within a 100-mile radius of this Air Force base or of this military installation. You would think they would have been, even with locals getting on site, you would have thought that the military that shot this down and knew that they shot it down would be the first ones to arrive on site or quickly, you know, arrive and then kind of dismiss everyone else. But it was actually the locals that came in, then called in the military to what was going on. And the first military personnel on site, like Jesse Marcel, they were the ones that came in and had no knowledge that we shot him out of the sky and that this was a recovery effort. I mean, doesn't that seem a bit far-fetched to you that the first wave of military that does arrive has no clue about this?
Well, the first wave of authority, I believe, memory serves me, was a sheriff.
Right, but I'm talking the first military wave. Once the local department got through. The
military came in and cordoned everything off and told everybody don't say anything, but the guy who was in charge at the time didn't know that it was going to be kept secret. So when asked by the local newspapers, he basically said the truth. He said, well, it was a saucer. And then later they recanted on that. Later they made up a bunch of stories about, you know, being a weather balloon and things like that.
All right. Now, I've heard about it being one, two craft in slightly different areas. This new third craft aspect is something I'd never heard before. And it took how long to locate this third knockdown craft?
I believe a couple of years. And this is information that came from some of the eyewitnesses that had given some of the latest testimonials to Dr. Greer. And he was, of course, gave it to me to help write his book and then eventually disseminate it into my book.
I mean, there's been so much said over the last 30 years regarding the Roswell incident since Stanton Friedman kind of reinvigorated the case and the story. Why do you think it took almost 70 years for eyewitnesses to finally come forward to share about a third downed craft? You would have thought somebody would have tried to cash in with the popularity of the movies, documentaries, film groups, people constantly seeking information. What was the reason that these people held off until now to come forward with their story?
I think from what I understand and from what I've read and what I've listened to in the testimonials, it was something that the last guy standing was given the opportunity to tell the truth, but he couldn't tell it until he was the last guy standing because his loyalty was for the military group that he basically worked under.
Okay. And the fact that this third craft came down and took a considerable amount of time to even locate before they realized that this was part of that same attack or that same squadron that had been knocked out of the sky. In all the time it went down, there was nobody that knew about this, or did some locals know about it and they kept it quiet? I mean, how did that unfold?
No, I think the third one, the farmer eventually found on his land and then he called the authorities. But they weren't aware that the third one had come down or where it had landed.
See, now, that seems so strange to me, too. And doesn't it to you, just as a student of human nature, that you know that a while ago there was a report that alien craft were shot down near Roswell or that there were two downed craft and debris was found, and then they quickly recanted the story and said it was a downed weather balloon, and then you stumble upon another craft and you're able to corroborate or at least change the history again by saying, hey, you know, local media, this was a UFO. I have a saucer down here. This isn't a balloon. Doesn't it just seem against human nature to have not had him report to somebody else about that at the time, especially coming off the heels of what had happened already in Roswell?
Well, let's go back. Let's say the shootdown happened in 1947, and in 1949, you're a farmer living in the New Mexico area of Roswell, and you go out to your land and you're farming with a tractor, and you come across this, what's left of an extraterrestrial vehicle. You're going to call the local paper, or you're going to call the local authorities?
I don't know. That's my point. I would have thought most people would have reached out to the local paper to say, hey, look at what we've got here, and as you know, especially as a farmer in the 40s, I would guess there would be a possible potential payday for alerting the press to this or sharing this kind of story and getting it out there.
But you're also worried about your family. You're also concerned about the authorities having a negative effect. You're also worried about radiation and poisoning. So you want to call it, would rather feel more comfortable.
Why do you think they would have been afraid at that time? They weren't aware of the men in black and the people being silenced for this, right? Especially somebody on the fringe out there. All they would have known is that, oh, there was a UFO crash. No, no, it was a mistake. It was, a governmental balloon test and this and that. I would have thought that would have just ended the whole speculation or concern that people were being silenced. At the time, were people aware that others that had witnessed this were going missing or that there was threats being made to them?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't there. I haven't made it my life's work to study this, so right. I couldn't exactly extrapolate what a farmer would find or what he feels that the most important thing would do. I know that if I was in his shoes, I probably would have done the same thing. I would have wanted the authorities to come out to make sure that my family was safe and that there was no radiation coming from these things.
Okay. Did any of the people that you interviewed and Dr. Greer spoke to, these people that did come forward, were they ever threatened because they had knowledge of this information?
Let me just be clear. I've never interviewed anybody. I was given
access. Right, but you edited, you went through the information that was given to you, and through those accounts, did they not relay that kind of information in those stories?
Several of them did. Many of them who were with the military, swore these people to secrecy, and yes, there were threats. So, the first guy who had come across, one of the locals who had come across this, these two crash ships, he was basically warned not to speak about it, but he did speak about it to his daughter. And years later, she came forward with the evidence that her father had confessed that, yeah, guess what we found out there? It was not a weather balloon. It was a spaceship.
And did anybody that came forward receive compensation for sharing their story?
I don't know. And if they had, I'm not sure they would have made that public knowledge.
Okay. Well, I was wondering, did Dr. Greer have to pay to get these people to share these stories, or was it something that these people just wanted to clear their conscience or finally open up about?
I think it was the latter. I think they wanted to clear their conscience. I think they wanted people to make it known that they're, in this case, the daughter, that the father had come across this. And
right. Now, you understand the kind of question on that, right? Then it kind of calls into account the believability of the story. If it's somebody who's only willing to come forward for a payday, is the story legitimate, or are they just trying to insert themselves into this history?
Well, I think you need to move beyond that. You're looking at what the locals' testimony was, but the more important testimony was the military, who had access to this information, who had access to these. One of the eyewitnesses that was the most important eyewitness that Dr. Greer felt in unacknowledged, and his information was woven and undisclosed, was a military guy who was debriefed at one of these military bases and got to see the actual footage that was taken of the crash, and got to see the actual the transcripts of what had happened, and so he came out, he came forward and told Dr. Greer all this information, as well as a lot of other mind-blowing information that is filtered throughout the books.
Okay, interesting. So he comes forward, and as he starts to open up about this, he was directly involved in the military. This was something that it was a grave secret, something that he was going to keep until he was the last man standing. And was he told by someone to share it at that point, or was this just an understanding that he and some of the other witnesses made between them? This story will come out between us. One of us has to agree that whoever the last man is before their time, they have to share this.
No, in his case, in most of the more modern day cases, it's a question of once these intelligence officers or military personnel who have been exposed to this stuff, who have been eyewitness to these things. Thousands of people at these military bases bore witness to these ships that were moving at incredible speed and then would stop on a dime and make a 90-degree turn. And what made them comfortable enough to come to Dr. Greer was the fact that he made them realize through these other eyewitnesses in the Disclosure Project that they were not breaking their vow of secrecy to the military by coming forward, because, in fact, the fact that these things are being kept secret from the president and members of Congress makes them illegal. And so if something is illegal, they're allowed, it doesn't, their vow of silence doesn't have to justify being silent, that they're allowed to talk about this. And I think that was one of the most important things Dr. Greer and his attorneys came forward with, that they could speak in public about this, because in fact, these were covert programs called USAPs, which stands for Unacknowledged Special Access Projects, which is why the book and the movie are called Unacknowledged. These unacknowledged special access projects are illegal. They're being illegally funded with black ops dollars that are taxpayer monies. And over the years, trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars have been spent on these USAPs. And that was one of the purposes of writing these two books, to get this kind of information out to the public. So it's not that Roswell was so important. Roswell was important because it was the first. But who said this and who said that and who kept the secret, that's not as important as the other information that followed with these USAPs, because, and we're talking about moon bases, and we're talking about special access projects that are covering up energy sources that could change the world.
Well, let's cover that when we return. Our guest this evening, Steve Alton, he is the co-author, editor, and involved in the book Unacknowledged, an expose of the world's greatest secret. Also, the author of a brand new novel, Undisclosed. We'll have links up to both of those books. Stay tuned. There's more coming your way here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is Beyond the Darkness. All right. Unacknowledged, an expose of the world's greatest secret. That's the book by Stephen Greer, and is co-authored and edited by Steve Alton, who's here with us tonight. He also has a brand new novel out. It is, how did you refer to this, Steve? What kind of, it's faction?
Faction instead of fiction. It's fiction wrapped around so much fact that the lines are blurred between fact and fiction, and in fact, the facts are more astounding than the fiction.
Excellent. Undisclosed, a novel. That's the name of it. We'll have links up to both books. And again, make sure you purchase those using our Amazon link. All right. You've also got ways for people to keep up with you and the work of these books. What websites can they visit?
They can visit my website, www.stevealton.com, and see book trailers for all of the Undisclosed and Unacknowledged books, as well as some of my other books. And Dr. Stephen Greer's website is www.SiriusDisclosure.com. That's S-I-R-I-U-S, disclosure.com.
All right. Now, before the break, you were talking about some of the people that had come forward, some of the stories that they had shared, but you said that wasn't even the most important part of this story. Let's jump back in from there. Where do you feel this goes? What is the most important and significant finds from the information that you were able to garner in this new book?
I think there's two things. One is a very positive potential thing, and one is a very negative thing. The positive thing is that the USAPs, which are these unacknowledged special access projects, one of the things that they're covering up is a type of energy called zero-point energy. And zero-point energy is how these UFOs travel, but it's also something that we can use to save our planet from climate change, from poverty, from really change the entire world. And these zero-point energy devices exist, but they've been blackshelled by these entities, this Majestic 12 entity, which is now called MAGI. And the revelation that these USAPs exist, I think, is one of the most important things in both books. And to give you an idea what they are,
please.
To quote Dr. Greer, what is a USAP? It is a top-secret, compartmentalized project requiring special access, even for those with top secret clearance, and it is unacknowledged. That means that anyone, including your superiors or the president, asks you about it, your reply is that no such project exists. And basically, in other words, you lie about it. And people in these USAFs are dead serious about keeping their project under wraps, and they are prepared to do anything to maintain secrecy. And the granddaddy of all the USAFs is the UFO ET matter.
So in your estimation, the presidents have not been made aware of this legitimately. It has not come out through the organization or through the shadow government that's running these projects.
Well, Truman and Eisenhower, of course, were aware of that. Eisenhower was in the White House when Rockefeller first created MJ-12. Kennedy was aware of it, but he wanted to bring it out in the open, and it eventually got Marilyn Monroe killed and perhaps him killed as well, because Marilyn Monroe, Dr. Greer has a document that shows that the CIA was tapping her phones, and when she was in the love tryst between Jack and Bobby and they broke up with her, she threatened to go public with the UFO matter because Jack had, in pillow talk, talked to her about Roswell. And so that basically was her death warrant.
All right, so this information is out there, but the military or the group, is it even considered the military, the people that are running these secret projects? Is it outside of our military? What do we understand about that?
There's members that move back and forth between the military and the military industrial complex, the defense contractors, CIA, and members of the fossil fuel industry as well. And see, that's part of the big problem. The fossil fuel industry doesn't want zero point energy to be known. They don't want it out there because if it's out there, then we don't need oil and gas and coal.
This zero point energy has been bandied about for quite a while and spoken about, though. I mean, it's already considered to, exist. And you know, we hear about big oil, big pharma, all these major organizations and covert or federal government groups that are able to squash these things from coming forward. If the aliens have this technology and they want us to have this technology, why aren't they just, I mean, obviously they've got the ability to come here and in some cases control our missile silos, control our nuclear power plants. By, you know, with the ability to shut them down, I think they've shown their might. Why aren't they just coming forward with this instead of, allowing the government and groups to hide this information from us?
Well, I don't know if there is much concern about us having zero point energy as not killing ourselves with nuclear weapons or destroying the planet with carbon dioxide poisoning. But with the zero point energy, I mean, actually, you know, yes, we did reverse engineered from these craft, but at the same time, we also had scientists who were brilliant scientists who came up with their own discovery for it. And the first one was Nikola Tesla. It was Tesla who first discovered this fourth dimensional aspects of zero point energy. And in 1901, as far back as 1901, he was actually preparing to use the planet's own magnetic field as a giant dipole in order to broadcast electricity to ships at sea without any wires. And that experiment from Tesla in 1901 would have led to free energy for the world. So what happened? Well, J.P. Morgan happened. He intervened, and he was an industrialist, of course, who he had invested in copper wire to use in homes and businesses. And he decided that, no, you're not going to give away energy for free. We're going to make money from it. So before Tesla could conduct his experiment, J.P. Morgan got his cronies in Washington and shut it down. And basically, they confiscated all the scientists' papers and inventions, and it left them destitute. And this is a pattern, Dave, that repeats itself throughout history, that every time a scientist makes a breakthrough in zero-point energy, shut down. You have the patent laws. There's Section 181 of the U.S. patent law that allows the government to arbitrarily determine if a technology or device poses a threat to our national security. So you have rogue elements within the Defense Department, the CIA, the NSA, the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Energy, which basically have abused these patent laws to prevent scientists from patenting these breakthroughs.
But isn't the onus on them to prove that it is a something that can challenge or perhaps expose us in a bad way? I mean, these are things that can only benefit us, not hurt us. How are they able to hide underneath that regulation?
Well, because the people don't have a choice. For instance, T. Townsend Brown, which was, I think he was considered the father of electrogravitics. He discovered, he discovered access to zero point energy by utilizing high voltages with it that caused levitation. The vessel that he was using to levitate off the ground. So, well, what happened was he was denied a patent and all his work was confiscated. And there's nothing they can do about it. Stan Meyer and Steve Meyer back in the 1980s, they discovered that hydrogen and oxygen mix could replace gasoline. They actually retrofitted a dune buggy to run on water, and word spread. And the next thing, the CIA is contacting Stan about retrofitting a Learjet, and he ends up dead. They poisoned him right into the restaurant that they met him in. I mean, these guys play for keeps. There's a lot of money at stake. There's a lot of power at stake, and they don't mess around.
And there's no money to be made in this zero point energy, in creating the equipment that it takes to run them and service them and keep them flowing?
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about the difference between a typewriter and a computer, the difference between a horse and buggy and a 21st century car. But the people that are in business with the horse and buggy don't want to give it up. So that's what we're facing right now. The people who control the top 1% are calling the shots, because we have Wall Street runs on fossil fuels.
I understand that aspect of it, but isn't there something that can be patented, manipulated? I mean, we've learned so much through time, and technology has made leaps, as you said, from a typewriter to our cell phones, which are more powerful than most computers were in the 1950s, that took up an entire room. Is there not a way that they can make just as much money without damaging the planet as much as they are, using some of the technology that has been culled from these alien interactions? I you know what I'm saying? I mean, if you don't go directly to the zero point energy, I understand that's taking it from crawling out of the swamps to suddenly running a marathon. Are there no steps in between that they could take to slowly escalate but still maintain money while keeping our planet safer?
Well, you're mimicking my conversation when I first met Dr. Greer. I was saying the same exact thing. Can't we try this? Can't we try that? There must be something we can do. The problem is that if you have this breakthrough in zero point energy, the first thing you want to try to do is patent it, and they're not going to patent any of these devices. The second problem is that if you have investors who want to invest in your business, they're not going to invest in it unless it is patented, because somebody else will steal it. But let's say that you don't need a patent. Let's say that you have an investor who's just got so much money to spend,
right,
and he wants to do the right thing for the world. You have to do it out in the open. You have to do it transparent. You have to do it in real time on the internet, because if you don't, if you try to cover it up, if you try to make it secret, there's no way that you can keep any of these things secret. It's just the way society is, the way the NSA is, the way that these agencies are. They know about what you're doing before you even do it. So they will shut you down or kill you or poison you, as John Searle was poisoned and Stan Meyer was poisoned, only he didn't recover. He died. I mean, this is the big boy league, and it's disgusting.
And there's no foreign countries that have scientific minds that have been able to crack this code themselves with information that I would think that if Russia or China could grab onto this information, they know that it would destabilize our economy and cause a lot of our industry to self-destruct. That would be in their favor, wouldn't it, to see that collapse and they be the first to come forward with this information?
Well, this organization that is, running things and has its tentacles in all sorts of agencies in the military and the Pentagon, also has its tentacles in Russia and China and other, Japan and other countries as well. And so, But the good news is that most of the people involved in these organizations, Dr. Greer believes it's up to as many as 70% of the people that are involved in this organization, want the technologies to get out to the masses. They, they have children and grandchildren. They want the world to be a better place. They see climate change as a real thing. The problem is that the old school guys who run these things, the 30%, are basically sociopaths like Dick Cheney. And, you know, they don't care about that. They want to keep our civilization in a constant state of war, because war is profitable, and war is where you control the power and control the people, and that's what they want. And that's the disgusting, that's the dark side of this whole thing.
All right. Tell me a little bit more about the information that you open up with this book. Where, what other information came in that was even a surprise to you at this point?
Dave, I'll tell you something. The months that I spent editing this book and working on it and putting it together were, the every day was mind-boggling stuff. I've had dreams about this stuff. I mean, I was absorbed in it 24/7. And I mean, the stuff that we talked about is just the very tip of a huge iceberg. The stuff that's underneath the water is just so mind-boggling, and it's covered in both of these books. But I mean, to me, learning that there's extraterrestrial moon bases on the dark side of the moon, that was mind-boggling. That NASA knows about these things, that the Apollo 11 landing, they knew that they were going to possibly come across interstellars when they landed the capsule. And they actually prepared for it by filming B-roll in a studio, I believe it was in New York, of the flag and of the astronauts. They shot B-roll so that on the delay, if any of these interstellar ships were coming up on the TV cameras, that they would switch to the B-roll. And they actually did that with a shot of the flag, only the flag was moving. And that's what sort of gave the moon landing conspiracy party, you know, the fodder, that the red meat that they needed to claim that the moon landing never happened. And what did happen, and the extraterrestrials were in force at the landing, and they didn't want us there.
And understand, this next question is not meant to sound crude or crass, but if there is all of the secrecy and shadiness going on around this, how is Stephen Greer and Steve Alton still alive? How are they able to release this book and not have their own lives compromised or those of the people they love?
Well, I'm just getting started in it. I'm just the guy who put the information together in an easily digestible format. Dr. Greer, his life has been at stake in jeopardy. He had an attempt on his life years ago, several attempts on his life. He's had his assistant murdered. He's had a colleague who was in the Senate, for a senator of New Mexico, murdered. In fact, one of the things that was the most tragic things that occurred to him was that an ally of his came forward and said he was good friends with a person in the government who was a member of Majestic 12, who wanted to come forward and give him a zero-point energy device and $50 million in seed money to develop this. And so Dr. Greer wanted to know who it was, and the guy wouldn't tell him. He said, well, if you don't tell me, I can't protect him. And the guy said, he doesn't want your help that way. He has his own protection. So they agreed to meet, and a couple days prior to the meeting, this guy was executed. And that guy was this former CIA director, William Colby, who was found dead in the his body washed up on the Potomac 9 days after he went missing. 9 days is a significant period because it wipes away the evidence of his murder. And so Greer would never do that again. He said he would never meet with anybody without knowing firsthand who it was, so he can use his sources to protect them.
Did you know this? Did your wife know this prior to you taking on this project?
No.
All right. No. Had you known all of this, would you have still done this? Would you have moved forward?
Yes, because it's the right thing to do. Because I've tried doing something like that years ago in one of my other novels called The Shell Game, where I disseminated information in a novel that had to do with the truth behind 9/11, and that it was a false flag event and who was involved in it. And the person that I was involved in at that time, who wrote a book called Crossing the Rubicon, he eventually killed himself because of all the pressure. So, and I have Parkinson's today, probably from the stress from writing that book. But, you know, you have to make a decision in life. What do you want to do? And I decided to do the right thing, not the easy thing.
Are you concerned? Do you and your wife look over your shoulders now that a book like this has come out that you're maybe getting on the wrong radar?
Well, the danger was before the book came out. Now the book's in every Barnes & Noble in the country, and every book's a million in the country, and it's available on Amazon, both books. And I wrote a book of fiction, which is really faction, but you know, in both books we name names, we name locations, we name the entities that are involved in these things. We don't pull any punches, and once the information is public, what are they going to do?
Talk to me about the people that you're able to name in this. Who were you able to come forth and reveal that might have been even a surprise to you and Dr. Greer at that point?
Well, Dr. Greer, his eyewitnesses talk about the agencies involved, and I'll read to you a small list of U.S. government agencies with current or past involvement. Include the NRO, which is the National Reconnaissance Office, the NSA, the CIA, the military divisions, and the Army, Air Force, and Navy. Private corporation believed to be involved include Northrop Grumman, Boeing Aircraft, Lockheed Martin, BDM, E-Systems, EG&G, and the list goes on and on. But you have to realize that most of the people who work in these organizations don't know that they're involved in a USAP, an Unacknowledged Special Access Project, because they're so compartmentalized that they're each group is working on a piece of the puzzle, but they have no idea what the puzzle looks like when it's put together.
So they're under the concept that they're working on something to do with this, but it's actually just a small fraction of a much larger puzzle.
Correct.
But the people in charge are the ones that know the grand scope of this conspiracy. The individual workers have no clue that this is what they're actually, that they're just cogs in a wheel that's going round and round.
That's correct. And one of the USAPs is something called an ARV, which is an alien reproduction vehicle. An ARV it looks exactly like a UFO. It was reconstructed, it was reverse engineered, and it can perform almost exactly like a UFO. The only difference is that UFOs are seamless and they're almost biological entities, whereas opposed to the ARVs, which are more ships, but they run on zero-point energy as well. But what has happened is that, and this was, I found that this was astounding as well, that Earth is actually quarantined. We have the technology to travel across space, but we don't have the license to do it. The interstellars that are calling the shots aren't going to let us do that because we haven't earned it yet, because we're not spiritual creatures that have the capacity to say no. And once we get to that point where we stop trying to kill each other and make war all the time, and once we get past that, then we'll have the green light to go explore.
Well, that's a pretty safe out, isn't it? That's the silly part. I mean, we've only become more and more of a warring world with every new generation, new ways to kill each other, new ways to cause destruction. Do you think we're ever going to come to some real bed of enlightenment that will allow us to open up, and that the aliens will come forth then and give us this information or allow the travel to take place?
Well, Dave, that's the beauty of being able to write fiction. I can write my own ending. And so Undisclosed is about what happens when we finally do get to that point, the elements that are necessary to happen, the things that happen in the year 2017 toward the end of this year, and create one possible alternative ending. But we also give another possible alternative ending that's a real scare. One of the scariest things about this whole thing is that Dr. Greer has eyewitnesses who have come forward to him and testified that there's another false flag that has been planned for decades now using these ARVs and using artificial life forms that are made to look like aliens. And this false flag is basically a recreation of the movie Independence Day. And it's being organized so that it gives the people in charge total control of the world, that we're in this constant state of war with a common enemy, which would be extraterrestrials. It's the farthest thing from the truth. But one of the things that both of these books and the documentary that he did tend to try to expose is this insidious false flag event. So the more we talk about it on shows like yours, the less likely it is to come true.
They seem to be prepping us. You know, there's been a lot of ties to Hollywood and You know, even going back to Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters, there's been involvement with different governmental agencies and memos that have leaked and stories that have leaked. And, you know, some of these stories have come out and people wonder if this is the way the government is slowly adapting us, kind of desensitizing us to the possibility of this kind of contact. Do you think there's any truth to that?
There's a whole lot of truth to that. It's a great point, Dave, because, you know, one of the things I say is, you know, I ask people that interview me, do you believe in God? Do you, Dave, believe in God? A higher power, a creator, a spiritual entity out there. Do you believe in it?
Yes.
Now, why do you believe in it? Because you were raised that way, correct?
Right.
Now, if you were raised to believe that there was not a creator out there or the creator was evil, then that's what you would believe as well. Well, the question I have is, if you believe in God, do you believe in UFOs? Now, we have no physical evidence that God exists. We, you know, some people claim to have spoken to God, but they're little mishugana. But we, you know, most people that can't talk to God, and God doesn't talk back to us. But do you believe in UFOs? Well, we've been taught that UFOs, if you believe in UFOs, you're crazy. And yet millions of people have seen them. People in Phoenix, Arizona, the Phoenix Lights years ago, tens of thousands of people saw them. And the next day, the governor came out and made fun of the whole thing by bringing out a guy dressed in an alien suit. And then he said, well, we captured the lights, and here he is. So this is the way we've been taught to be. We've been conditioned to believe that these things don't exist, even though we see it for our own self. It's sort of like the story about the king's new clothes, the emperor's new clothes. Everybody's been conditioned to believe that the emperor has a beautiful new suit, but the guy's butt naked. Well, the UFOs are really out there, and we've seen them. I've seen them. Other people have seen them. I've talked to people who have seen them. And people in above top secret clearances in these books not only have seen them, but they tell us how they've interacted with them.
Now that the book is out and you're sharing this information, are more people coming forward with information that you didn't even have at the time of the publishing of these two books in the documentary? Are you getting even more than you expected from this release?
I think it has the potential to lead to that, and I'll tell you what the game plan is. The game plan, and your audience can help out, your listeners can help out in a big way. You see, if the way to pierce, and this is what I discussed with Dr. Greer 3 years ago, the way to pierce the mainstream media's gauntlet, where the mainstream media is controlled by the CIA because they own it, the way to pierce it is to get these books to be on the New York Times bestseller list, because that triggers a couple things. If even for just 1 week, both of these books were on the New York Times bestseller list, that would contribute a buy order from organizations like Walmart, Kmart, Sam's, grocery store chains, drugstore chains. And that would get disseminate the information to a lot more people who normally wouldn't even bother to read it. One of the reasons I wrote Undisclosed as a novel is because people will not buy Unacknowledged because it's simply what the book is about. But they would read a thriller, and the information could be disseminated to them through the thriller. Now, once the book is on the New York Times list, a lot of things happen. It goes to the Frankfurt Book Fair in October, where it can be disseminated to publishers all across the world. It can be considered for a TV series or a movie, just like one of my other series, Meg, is being made into a movie that will be out in August 10th, 2018. So once you get large masses of people that are exposed to the truths that are written in both of these books, now you have a public outcry. Give us zero point energy. Stop. Give us the patents that we can create these technologies ourselves. That forces the government to act, just like the government was forced to act when people came out demanding their health care not be destroyed. That's the power of the public.
All right. Well, we wish you a lot of luck with that, Steve. Steve Alton, our guest, Unacknowledged is the name of the book that he worked on with Dr. Steven Greer. His new novel, A Book of Faction, which is fact and fiction woven together, to tell a very compelling story, Undisclosed, a novel. We'll have links up to both of those. You can check them out on our site at Beyond the Darkness. You can find that at darknessradio.com. You can find it on the podcast links and more. So make sure you check for that. Tomorrow, we're going to explore parallel worlds and other dimensions. Our guest is Timothy Beckley here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Hello and welcome. It's time for another True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. The New York Times bestseller, The Monster of Florence, a true story. Douglas Preston, who joined us on Beyond the Darkness a few months back talking about another one of his books, is here to talk to us about this true crime book. Doug Preston is the author of 35 books, both fiction and nonfiction, 16 of which have been New York Times bestsellers, several reaching the number one position. And this one, The Monster of Florence, this is a chilling, chilling book. And it surprises me that many of us in the United States don't even know about this case. Welcome back to the show, and thank you for coming on to share this with us today.
Well, thank you, Dave.
I need to know, how do you go from the Lost City of the Monkey God, which we talked about a few months ago on Beyond the Darkness, to a true crime book like this? How, you know, I mean, obviously you're the Indiana Jones of our time, and you're out there putting yourself in the middle of these stories, but walk me through your introduction to this story.
Well, you know, I think I hate to say this, but it's sheer stupidity on both accounts. I mean, I'm a journalist, and in both stories, I fell into the story, and in The Monster of Florence, I fell in a big way and became actually a suspect in the case, if you can believe it. So it was very exciting. It was quite terrifying while it lasted, but it's all over now, thank God. And I got a good book out of it, but it's quite a story.
Way to look at the upside. Yeah. You became a suspect in this crime.
I did, yes, and it's crazy. I'll tell you how the Italian police arrest you. That's pretty funny, but
we'll get into all of that. Let's start at the very beginning, though. Now, you moved your family to Florence, and, you know, this wasn't even on your radar. It wasn't like you were going there to research this story, correct?
That's right. I was going there actually to write a novel, a murder mystery set in Florence, and I wanted to find out what happens when the Italian police find a dead body. What do they do? So I found this journalist, and he explained to me what happens, how the Italian police operate, and then when he heard where I lived, he said, oh, he said, there are three sites in your neighborhood. There's the Villa La Sfacciata that was designed by Michelangelo. There's some other, you know, famous historic church. And then, of course, there's that olive grove right outside your house where the Monster of Florence murdered a young couple in one of the most horrific murders in Italian modern history. And I said, wait a minute. I said, the real estate agent didn't tell me about that one. But it turned out that I'd rented a house right next to this incredible murder scene of a serial killer who, between 1974 and 1985, murdered young lovers in the hills around Florence. And he would wait for them in ambush. He would kill the man and then kill the woman while they were having sex. And apparently he waited for the moment of most, you know, distraction or whatever, murder them, and then he would take the woman away from the man and perform a ritualistic mutilation. I mean, this guy makes Jack the Ripper look like, you know, Captain Kangaroo. I mean, he was the most horrific serial killer, really, that I've ever encountered. And I'm a collector of dark stories.
All right. Well, now, what year is this that you moved in to Florence?
Well, I moved in the year 2000. So the last murder was in 1985. So it had been 15 years. But the case was still open. The Italian police were still looking for the Monster of Florence. And the investigation had grown into this cancerous or hydra-headed monster itself with hundreds of suspects. Thousands of men had been interrogated. It was the most expensive criminal investigation in Italian history. It was absolutely crazy.
And how many people were murdered between 68 and 85?
14 people, seven couples. And the couple that was murdered in the olive grove right outside my house were, it was actually a gay couple, and the man had very long blonde hair, so he looked like a woman. So when the monster killed them, he thought he was killing a woman, but then when he discovered he'd made a mistake, he became enraged and trashed the place and tore everything up and was, you know, went crazy because he had made a mistake like that. But all the others were heterosexual couples killed while they were making love.
1968 to 1985, so it's quite a span for 14 murders. Not that I'm by any size or and by any means belittling the size of this kill. Was there a cyclical nature? Now, you mentioned that it was done in a very kind of ritualistic way. Do we find that it was on full moons, blood moons, new moons? Why so few for all of these years?
Well, very good question. The monster killed almost invariably on a Saturday night with no moon, and so that he could operate in complete darkness. And he also used the same gun, was a .22 Beretta, the same box of 50 bullets. When he ran out of bullets, he opened a new box. Apparently he used the same knife. He had, and probably, according to the psychological profilers, he probably treated this whole thing in a ritualistic fashion, wearing the same clothes, doing everything exactly the same way. You know, very, very strange kind of ritualistic thing that he was up to here.
Now, this sounds very reminiscent of the Zodiac killings here in the United States.
Very close. In fact, the Italian police at a point were so stumped that they went to the American FBI and they said, will you prepare a psychological profile of the monster of Florence for us using, you know, using that famous psychological unit at Quantico that was made so famous by The Silence of the Lambs.
Right.
So the FBI did that. And they identified that the monster belonged to a type of serial killer who murdered young lovers like the Zodiac killer and, you know, performed them in a ritualistic fashion. In fact, they had a database of serial killers who did this sort of thing. They killed for libidinous purposes, for sexual purposes. They didn't rape the women. They probably were impotent, unable to do it. So the only way they could possess a woman was to possess her when she was having sex with a man, another man, drag her away from the man, and then perform this mutilation, which included taking home body parts.
How horrific. Once you realize that this happened literally in your backyard, Douglas, and it's right there, you went there to write a crime novel. Suddenly, you're embroiled in a real-life true crime. Were you originally playing with the idea of just modeling your story on this real case, or did you realize, no, I need to cover this real case and find out more about it?
I wanted to cover the real case. I threw away my novel immediately. I said, that's nothing.
Right.
I just stumbled on one of the most remarkable stories. Now, I was freaked out. I didn't even tell my wife for a while. And we had kids, too. You know, I mean, I was a little freaked out by this, but I thought, you know, this is an opportunity. As a journalist, you don't come across stories like this very often. It was a completely unknown story to Americans at the time. And the gentleman that I, this friend of mine who was an Italian journalist, Mario Spezzi, had covered all the murders for the local paper. So we had a huge archive on these killings. And I said to Mario, let's you and I write a book about this. And it'll be in English and also in Italian. Mario actually didn't speak, write, or read Italian, but English. But, you know, he wrote part of the book and I translated it into English. But he had this archive, and he actually at a certain point said to me, you know, he said, I'm pretty sure I know who the monster of Florence is. And I said, really? I said, should we go interview him? And he said, never. I will never interview him. I'm too frightened.
Subscribe now for True Crime Tuesday by visiting darknessradio.com and clicking the True Crime Tuesday banner. Never miss another episode of True Crime Tuesday and Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Go there now, darknessradio.com, and click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. Do it now.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.